This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Inside the uncanny world of TikTok home remodeling. Turn a tree into a luxury apartment. Retrofit a bedroom for a million children. The videos are bizarre, and it's going very viral. Who is behind them? By Sean Broderick. If you've been on TikTok at any point in the past 6 months, chances are you've stumbled across them, as I first did during a fairly routine doom scroll one night this summer. For me, it started with two videos somewhat incongruously tagged hashtag home remodeling and hashtag house design. One of them featured a CGI man summoning a baby phoenix outside of a tree that he planned to turn into an apartment. Then a robotic AI voice started to narrate how the CGI man, identified as Little John, was going to build it. Over the next 90 seconds, Little John transformed the tree into a maniacally space-efficient luxury unit in an AI-generated ballet, a flying galvanized square steel, eco-friendly wood veneer, and expansion screws. The other video, featuring nearly identically CGI and the same hypnotically flat AI narrator, followed the story of a couple with a billion children that, like Little John, decided it was time to improve their home. And those two videos were only the tip of the galvanized ice steel iceberg. There are hundreds of accounts posting these videos to TikTok right now, and they've become immensely popular, racking up millions of views. Even the character of Little John has become a meme of his own, with people making skits where they pretend to be him. The video struck me as fascinating, a case study of how TikTok trends have evolved, or rather devolved, over time. What was once an app full of human beings making content in conversation with each other has become a dizzying world where the irony and sincerity, memes and spam, blur together into a slurry of bizarre content no one is quite sure what to do with. As I set out to discover who was making these videos, I assumed that lifting the rock would reveal an even stranger world of broken social networks, AI content farms, and shady engagement hacks wiggling just beneath the surface of the web, which it did. But stranger still, in the end, it turned out these videos hadn't become huge as TikTok trend at all. In 2022, an account popped up on TikTok called @designer_Bob. From the start, it exclusively posted videos with a specific format. Some kind of weird domestic issue must be solved with extreme home renovation. The action animated in a surreal CGI style with a spunky stock music soundtrack. Within a month, the account had a viral hit, a video about designing a bedroom for four children, which has been viewed more than 10 million times. Designer Bob's formula proved perfect for TikTok's algorithm, which is constantly analyzing in microseconds what catches your attention and recalibrating to what it thinks you want to watch. There's a hypnotic quality to these videos. The storyline is just fucked up enough to grab your attention early on, says social media analyst Rachel Carton. And because there's a process happening, a home renovation, the user can't look away. Once Designer Bob's videos started going viral, hundreds of other accounts started posting similar content. One account called @dy02449xjp, which had been sharing clips from 2000s rom-coms like The Proposal and 2 Weeks' Notice, switched over to weird home renovations in January 2024. That same month, one of the videos went exceptionally viral. It's been watched more than 44 million times. Along the way, the aesthetic and style of these videos started to change. The early viral renovation videos from Designer Bob were silly, but could sometimes be mistaken for genuine design content. Newer videos were more ludicrous, the renovations more fantastical, their action narrated by a droning AI voice. That's just the way TikTok's remix culture works, says Alex Turvey, who studies digital culture. We're going to see trends like this become more and more absurd until they burn out, he says. There's even a spin-off meme specifically about, quote, galvanized square steel to the point where some users have questioned whether the whole meme is a viral marketing campaign for galvanized steel. I think lore is a really good word to use here. Now the videos blow up and do well because there is lore around them, Carton said. Lore sustains virality. The more I watched these videos, the more desperate I was to understand who was making them. In the case of Designer Bob, the account bio links to an online candle and crystal store run by a company based in China called Whisper Wisp. And the Designer Bob Facebook page lists Hong Kong as a base on the page transparency section. Still, it seems unlikely this is a covert marketing campaign for a candle shop. None of Whisper Wisp's social channels are nearly as popular as the Designer Bob account. Whisper Wisp didn't respond to any of my messages. Details about who's behind the DY02449XJP account are even more scarce. There's a Facebook page with the same username sharing the same videos. Beyond that, nothing. No other connected accounts, no storefronts or identifying information. If there's a scam or an upsell coming, it hasn't dropped yet. For now, at least, DY02449XJP appears to be pursuing TikTok engagement for its own sake. Many of these accounts use the same variation of the name, quote, home designs and similar logos of a small house, which strongly resemble the branding of an architecture and interior design program called Home Designs AI. A major clue, I thought, towards solving the mystery. I was able to track down Home Design AI's COO and co-founder, Dennis Madrone. But he was just as confused as everyone else about how popular these renovation TikToks have become. Home Design AI is a Romania-based startup that launched in 2023. The app allows users to upload a photo of a room or floor plan and transform it using AI. Madrone says he's starting seeing TikToks that use Home Design's AI last year. He says he and his team thought they were pretty funny, but they're not seeing much upside. Madrone confirmed that the Home Design's AI does have a TikTok account, though it doesn't really participate in the memes. It has a little under 900 followers, and its biggest video has around 195,000 views, which seems fine until you compare it to the unofficial Home Design's TikTok account on TikTok. The biggest one, at HomeDesign369, has 2.3 million followers and is consistently getting millions of views per video. Our official account is severely underperforming compared to the numbers averaged by user-generated content, Madrone concedes. But as it turns out, none of the most viral Little John TikToks were made using Home Design's AI software. So mystery unsolved. And before this summer, no one on TikTok seemed to know where these videos were coming from. That is, until Candice Lin, a Cantonese and Mandarin tutor based in the U.S., noticed the trend going viral and revealed the missing piece of the puzzle, at least for confused Americans, in a TikTok video of her own. It turns out we haven't actually been watching videos made by TikTok users. They're coming from a completely different app. As Lin explains, these videos come from Bilibili, China's closest equivalent to YouTube. On Bilibili, Little John is known as Big John. Galvanized steel is even a trending search term. And according to Lin, there are two Bilibili users known for creating this kind of content. One account called Crazy Designer, another called Design Aunt Wang. I was able to find dozens of other accounts as well. The unhinged home renovation videos on TikTok are machine-translated versions of video from Bilibili. Chinese content makes the jump across the Great Firewall like this fairly often. Videos downloaded from TikTok's sister app Douyin are a regular presence on TikTok. But the fact that these were not made for English-speaking audiences would explain the robotic narrator, bizarre syntax, and the Chinese iconography seen throughout. After digging through Crazy Designer's videos, I was able to find one of the videos I had come across on TikTok back in June about a couple designing a house for a billion children. Crazy Designer titled it, quote, 1 billion children per room, and is part of a series all with titles like A Million Children Per Room or 2 million children per room, and so on. After watching it on Bilibili and reading the comments underneath of it, I started to realize what these video are. They're shitposts. The jaundiced real estate porn is meant to satirize the housing crunch in cities like Hong Kong and Shanghai, and the commenters are all in on the joke. In the end, it appears there isn't any kind of scam or engineering marketing stunt here after all. It's just two cultures laughing at the same uncanny user-generated content, filtered through some perfunctory layers of AI translation and lost context. And according to Lynn, Bilibili users are not aware of how popular Little John videos have become in the West. They're mortified that the Americans are watching. Wait, go back. Machine readable. If the robots take over, we should at least speak their language. By Sean Hahn. To mature as programmers, newer generations need to take a lesson from Google's programming language. Many of today's programmers, software engineers, consider themselves, quote, creatives, artists of a sort. They are given to ostentatious personal websites with cleverly hidden Easter eggs and parallax scrolling. They confer upon themselves multi-hyphenate job titles, quote, ex-Amazon engineer, investor, author, and crowd their laptops with identity signaling vinyl stickers. Some regard themselves as literary sophisticates. Consider the references smashed into certain product names. Apache Kafka, Scylla DB, Claude 3.5 Sonnet. Much of that, I admit, applies to me. The difference is I'm a tad short on talents to hyphenate in my toy projects with names like Nabokov. I know. Are better off staying on my laptop. I entered this world pretty much the moment software engineering overtook banking as the most reviled profession. There's a lot of hatred and self-hatred to contend with. Perhaps this is why I see the ethos behind the programming language go as both a rebuke and a potential corrective to my generation of strivers. Its creators hail from an era when programmers had smaller egos and fewer commercial ambitions, and it is, for my money, the premier general-purpose language of the new millennium. Not the best at any one thing, but nearly the best at nearly everything. A model for our flashy times. If I were to categorize programming languages like art movements, there would be a mid-century utilitarianism, Fortran and COBOL, high-theory formalism, Haskell, AGDA, AmeriCorporate pragmatism, C++ and Java, grassroots communitarianism, Python and Ruby, and esoteric hedonism, Befunge and Brainfuck. And I'd say Go, often described as C for the 21st century, represents neoclassicism, not so much a revolution as a throwback. Back in 2007, three programmers at Google came together around the shared sense that standard languages like C++ and Java had become hard to use and poorly adapted to the current, more cloud-oriented computer environment. One was Ken Thompson, formerly of Bell Labs and a recipient of the Turing Award for his work on Unix, the mitochondrial Eve of operating systems. These days, OS people don't mess with programming languages. Doing both is akin to an Olympic high jumper also qualifying for the marathon. Joining him was Rob Pike, another Bell Labs alum who, along with Thompson, created the Unicode encoding standard UTF-8. You can thank them for your emoji. Watching these doyens of programming create Go was like seeing Scorsese, De Niro, and Pesci reunite for The Irishman. Even its flippantly SEO-unfriendly name could be forgiven. I mean, the sheer chutzpah of it. A move only the reigning search engine king would dare. The language quickly gained traction. The prestige of Google must have helped, but I assume there was an unmet hunger for novelty. By 2009, the year of Go's debut, the youngest of mainstream languages were mostly still from 1995, a true annus mirabilis where Ruby, PHP, Java, and JavaScript all came out. And it wasn't that advancements in programming language design had stalled. Language designers are a magnificently brainy bunch, many with a reformist zeal for dislodging the status quo. but what they end up building can sometimes resemble a Starkitect's high-design marvel that turns out to have drainage problems. Most new languages never overcome basic performance issues. But from the get-go, Go was ready to go. I once wrote a small search engine in Python for sifting through my notes and documents, but it was unusually sluggish. Rewritten in Go, my pitiful serpent grew wings and took off, running 30 times faster. Some astute readers might have guessed this program was my Nabokov. This is not to say that Go is a perfect language. It's more workhorse than showhorse, and it came out 15 years ago, enough time for a stream of breakup stories and critiques to cycle through the industry's paper of record, Hacker News. To wit, many find Go code ugly. There's a Procrustean uniformity to it, and it lacks the tidy shorthands of, say, Ruby or Python, so even common patterns can become messy and cluttered. Ask a Go programmer about, quote, error handling. Also, you can't run the code, even with correct syntax, unless certain styles are strictly followed. Imagine a word processor that does not allow you to save unless your essay is free of grammatical errors. I'm happy to admit that Go lacks the ergonomics of newer languages, but I struggle to dispel the suspicion that these are the complaints of a spoiled era. If the chief engineer of the first generation Ford Mustang were tasked with designing a new line of cars, and did so remarkably, models of practicality and workmanship, would you complain about them having no touchscreens? It's odd to think of how young the field of computer science is. Alan Turing's paper that launched the field is less than a century old, and we live in a small window of time where pioneers are alive and professionally active, even into their 80s. Go is a language created by people who had nothing left to prove. I hope it isn't too contrived to speak of a late style in programming. The idea is usually attributed to the German philosopher Theodor Adorno, who observed a growing contradiction and alienation in Beethoven's later work. The literary critic Edward Said expanded on the notion in his posthumous book On Late Style, discussing how some artists, when facing impending mortality, reject traditional artistic closure and instead embraced fragmentation and unresolved tension. What I find more intriguing, and rarer than we might have thought, are the cases where the masters in their later years do accept a certain closure, and, as Said put it, maintain a spirit of reconciliation and serenity. Social media has provided us with a disappointing yet sobering spectacle wherein supposedly accomplished individuals, since we're talking technology here, certain computer scientists and AI who shall remain nameless come to mind, regularly engage in unseemly reckonings with their residual baggage. But when I think about Go, I feel a sense of serenity. Instead of involving themselves in spats with young kvetchers, the Go team directs you to their FAQ page, the gold standard of FAQ pages, written in a gentle, statesmanlike tone. And with that, they rest their case. I suppose that's where some people do end up, completely, even plainly, at ease with their work. To know it's possible, someday, perhaps, is a balm. Maybe my generation will learn to tame our egos and find our footing. We still have a few decades to make it so. A full-term gig. Hiring someone to carry your baby to term is a booming business. The market for surrogacy is expected to expand to $129 billion by 2032, fueled by older parents, rising infertility, and more same-sex families. Silicon Valley contributes to the growth too. Tech companies like Google, Meta, and Snap pitch in up to $80,000 towards the six-figure cost of the process. Yet it's still controversial to, quote, rent a womb, as detractors call it. One human rights expert for the United Nations says that commercial surrogacy usually amounts to the sale of children. Critics claim the practice exploits poor women who are not fully informed of the hazards. In fact, the United States is one of the only developed countries that allows pregnancy for profit. The stereotypical gestational carrier is a stay-at-home mom who wants to earn income without leaving her kids. Many surrogates do fit that mold, but backgrounds and experiences vary greatly. One West Coast surrogate who has carried two sets of twins for parents in California and China opens up about what it's been like for her. In 2010, my best friend died of an accidental overdose, and I found his body a few days later. After that trauma, I went through a long period of examining my purpose. As a mother, I thought it would be really cool if I could give other people their reason for getting up in the morning. I also loved being pregnant. Surrogacy sounded like the world's greatest part-time job. I went through rigorous physical and psychological testing. Then I read tons of files from intended parents, waiting for that click. Finally, I met an older single guy, let's call him Greg. As a queer woman, I felt a strong community obligation to make babies for the gays. Surrogacy can be more accessible than adoption for some people. Greg told me, "I am an older, gay, single dad. Do you know how hard it would be for me to adopt an infant?" The doctor transferred three embryos into my uterus, hoping for one, but we got all three. For 13 weeks, literally all I did was eat, sleep, and grow humans. I was healthy, but because the risks to the babies, Dave ultimately decided to reduce the triplets down to twins. My doctor made me labor in the operating room in case something went haywire, but I delivered both twins vaginally. 20 minutes after pushing them out, I got up off the table, walked to the bed, and asked for a sandwich. A few years later, an agency reached out and told me a couple in China were offering Scrooge McDuck buckets of money. I had student loans, so that pregnancy was purely a monetary decision. It's become very popular to have surrogacy done in the U.S. because the babies are automatically citizens. The Chinese couple had specifically sex selected for girls, which was cool. Those twins were naturally a little smaller, so I didn't feel like I was schlepping giant Clydesdale babies around. The parents also asked me to give birth on a certain day, since it was lucky. I was like, "Fine, whatever you want, I'm just going to be eating croissants." For 6 weeks after the birth, I would drop off pumped breast milk and see the babies. The family made me fresh dumplings. It was a very nice situation. I still get pictures of the girls. I happened to be a professional dominatrix for 18 years. I suspect that having a very good grasp on boundaries and consent in my private life has translated into my professional life. It makes it easier to be able to say no. My medical autonomy is very important to me. These are your children, but this is my body, and I'm going to make the decisions that are best for everyone involved. It's also important to me to choose how I labor and choose my own doctor. I heard of one surrogate whose intended parents didn't want her to have any pain management during delivery, and that's a no for me. Give me that sweet epidural. If something is important to you, you need to put it in the contract. I knew a surrogate whose family asked if she'd kept kosher while pregnant. Others want you to eat only organic. If you agree to something and then don't do it, the intended parents can sue for breach of contract. If I violated my agreement, it specified that I'd be on the hook for about $50,000, about $20,000 more than I was being paid. Being a surrogate is like being a super intensive nanny. You absolutely can care about the kids, but they're not yours. When you're pregnant with your own, you're dreaming about them and naming them and nesting for them. With surrogacy, it's not the same. I love getting pictures of the twins, but I'm not in love with them. I often get asked, "Is surrogacy exploitative?" Usually young women ask this in a very snide way. I have to gently explain that I was paid for a service. I was paid very well. I was treated fairly, so I don't feel exploited at all. Other people's experiences can be different, of course. People grossly undervalue the physical effort it takes to carry a baby. They think, you just gain a little weight, and then you pop out a kid. No. People die all the time in childbirth. So understand that a surrogate is putting themselves in a dangerous medical situation to help other people. And I think it's fair that they are compensated for that risk. The Dad Rock Diplomacy of Antony Blinken. Two major wars, a rising China, hackers everywhere. He's from the U.S. government, and he's here to help. By Garrett graph. Here's a flash of Antony J. Blinken's turn as U.S. Secretary of State. In his first year, he navigated America's messy exit from Afghanistan. In his second, he tried to rally the world to Ukraine's side following Russia's invasion in February 2022. His third and fourth have been defined by the Israeli-Hamas conflict. In between, he has tried to box in rising Chinese aggression in Asia and slow Iran's march toward a nuclear weapon, even as the Islamic Republic has repeatedly plotted to assassinate his predecessor, Mike Pompeo, for his role in killing Iranian military leader Qasem Soleimani. Don't forget either about the normal mix of crises, coups, summits, treaties, global elections. More humans will vote in 2024 than any year in the world history. And this summer, the biggest prisoner swap with Russia since the end of the Cold War. Blinken, 62, once thought he might become a musician, or maybe even less lucratively, a journalist. Instead, he has spent virtually his entire career in the Washington foreign policy establishment, which is something of a family business. Both his father and uncle were ambassadors during the Clinton administration. In the 2000s, Blinken was the Democratic staff director for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he cemented his partnership with then-chair Joe Biden. During the Obama administration, Blinken was Biden's national security advisor, a role that delivered him a cameo in that presidency's most famous picture. Look carefully at the 2011 snapshot of Obama and top officials monitoring the killing of Osama bin Laden from the White House Situation Room, and there's Blinken, peeking over the shoulder of White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley. Blinken spent the final 2 years of Obama's presidency as Deputy Secretary of State, so it was hardly a surprise that he was one of Biden's first cabinet hires in 2021. At his confirmation hearing, Blinken shared that his stepfather had been the sole student among 900 children at his Polish school to survive the Holocaust. The job is personal and all-consuming, and it's not even one he can escape for a few hours at home. Protesters spent months this spring and summer camped outside his house with the hope of pressuring him to end the humanitarian crisis that has grown out of Israel's attack in the Gaza Strips. At times, they've poured fake blood on the road as the family, his wife, White House Cabinet Secretary Evan Ryan, and their 4 and 5-year-old kids drive in and out. He had visited roughly 90 countries in the past 3.5 years, including 15 trips to Israel. During one of his 7 trips to Ukraine, Blinken found a moment to rock out and play guitar at a club in Kyiv. A viral clip meant to highlight how Ukraine has survived more than 2 years of punishing war. In many of those trips and meetings, technology has been top of mind. In 2022, Blinken created a Bureau of Cyberspace and Digital Policy to lead the nation's overseas efforts on cybersecurity in the vital intersection of economic security and technology. And this May, he flew to San Francisco to give a keynote at the RSA conference, a security industry event where he joked, "Move fast and break things is literally the exact opposite of what we try to do at the State Department." His team is also trying to modernize the famously outdated tech used by the State Department's 77,000 employees across some 300 embassies, consulate, and U.S. offices. In early August, after Blinken returned from a trip through Laos, Vietnam, Japan, the Philippines, Singapore, and Mongolia, a journey one Chinese official labeled as his encirclement tour, I sat down with the secretary in his personal office at State's Foggy Bottoms headquarters, a small, cozy, wood-paneled room just steps and a few very armored doors from the building's more ornate and lavish diplomatic spaces. At that moment, headlines were warning of an escalating attack on Israel by Hezbollah and Iran, and Ukraine had just invaded Russia's Kursk region. Time was, of course, tight. His schedule is measured to the minute. So we dove right in, and Blinken talked as casually as the nation's top diplomat ever was. Garrett Graff. On your first day, you promised that you were going to leave behind a department that was ready for the 21st century. I want to ask you about the digital work that the department has done. In June 2023, of course, the State Department discovered the Chinese intrusion of Microsoft systems, For those of us who cover cybersecurity, it was shocking that the State Department would be the originator of discovering an event like that. Anthony Blinken. It was a little surprising for me, too. Both a pleasant surprise, because I was very proud of the fact that we have remarkable people in place who are able to do that. But of course, when you have any kind of cyber intrusion, it's a deep and ongoing concern. It's exactly why we've tried to make this department, among other things, fit for purpose when it comes to cybersecurity. Garrett, one of the things you've done is create this new cybersecurity bureau with Ambassador Nate Fick. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the effort. Blinken. Look, what I've seen since coming back to the State Department 3.5 years ago is that everything happening in the technological world and in cyberspace is increasingly central to our foreign policy. There's almost a perfect storm that's come together over the last few years. Several major developments that have really brought this to the forefront of what we're doing and what we need to do. First, we have a new generation of foundational technologies that are literally changing the world all at the same time, whether it's AI, quantum, microelectronics, biotech, telecommunications. They're having a profound impact, and increasingly they're converging and feeding off each other. Second, we're seeing that the line between the digital and physical worlds is evaporating, erasing. We have cars, ports, hospitals that are in effect, huge data centers. They are big vulnerabilities. At the same time, we have increasingly rare materials that are critical to technology and fragile supply chains. In each of these areas, the State Department is taking action. We have to look at everything in terms of stacks, the hardware, the software, the talent, and the norms, the rules, the standards by which this technology is used. Besides setting up an entire new Bureau of Cyberspace and Digital Policy, and the bureaus are really the building blocks of our department, we've now trained more than 200 cybersecurity and digital officers, people who are genuinely expert. Every one of our embassies around the world will have at least one person who is truly fluent in tech and digital policy. My goal is to make sure that across the entire department, we have basic literacy, ideally fluency, and even, eventually, mastery. All of this is to make sure that, as I said, this department is fit for purpose across the entire information and digital space. Graph. Your tenure here at Foggy Bottom has coincided with what feels like the fracturing of the dream of a global internet. We've begun to see these splintering into separate realms, a European regulatory web and authoritarian regimes using the internet as a surveillance tool. Of course, we've seen this play out in U.S. policy on Huawei and TikTok. Blinken. Ideally, we don't have that fracturing, and certainly that would be the preference. We've done a number of things, actually, to try to move in another direction, to try to build broad consensus on the way technology is used. Let me give you an example on AI. We had incredible work done by the White House to develop basic principles with the foundational companies. The voluntary commitment that they made, the State Department has worked with to internationalize those commitments. We have a G7 code of conduct, the leading democratic economies of the world, all agreeing to basic principles with a focus on safety. We managed to get the very first resolution ever on artificial intelligence through the United Nations General Assembly. 192 countries also signaling up to basic principles on safety and a focus on using AI to advance sustainable development goals on things like health, education, and climate. We also have more than 50 countries that have signed on to basic principles on the responsible military use of AI. The goal here is not to have a world that is bifurcated in any way. It's to try to bring everyone together. Having said that, you're right. There are areas where, of course, we are in intense competition with other countries. If we can't come together on rules that make sure that we're elevating the good and minimizing the bad, we have to make sure we're protecting our values and protecting our interests. For example, when it comes to the highest-end technology, say, the highest-end chips, we want to make sure that a country like China is not able to acquire those and then feed them directly into its military program. They're engaged right now in an extensive expansion of their nuclear program, very opaque, and it's not in our interest for them to have the highest-end technology. Also, technology is unfortunately used to repress people, for surveillance, and to repress their human rights. We want to make sure our technology is not used for that. We want to make sure that as we're protecting, as opposed to promoting technology in a way that has the smallest possible yard, along with the highest possible fence. Broadly speaking, we see technology profoundly as a source for good and for progress. But for discrete parts of the ecosystem, we have to make sure we're protecting. We have to have supply chains that are not only resilient, but diversified, so we're not dependent on any one place for any critical input. We went through COVID. We saw where we can lead. We don't want to see the same thing on critical technology. Garrett, let me ask you also about Russia and ransomware, another issue that has defined your tenure in the administration's national security agenda over the past couple years. Is there more that the United States and the Western Alliance could be doing to push Russia to be a better actor, or is this an intractable problem? Blinken. Look, it's an ongoing challenge. President Biden engaged President Putin on this earlier in his term. This was before the invasion of Ukraine. And we were making some progress on getting Russia to act in a more responsible way when it came to ransomware. Then the invasion of Ukraine happened. It's obviously made the entire relationship much more difficult than it already was. I think, unfortunately, there are probably limits to what we can achieve. Having said that, we're also working increasingly collaboratively, not only with the private sector, but with also other countries, to develop common strategies to build solidarity, because so many companies and countries are affected with this scourge of ransomware. Garrett, your predecessor, Mike Pompeo, came to this job with swagger. The word characterized his tenure and approach to the world. It feels like there's been a different tempo in the world events in the past few years, as if your tenure has been modified and more defined by the limits of American power, Afghanistan, Ukraine, the Middle East, and China. Blinken. I actually question the premise. I don't see the experience that we've had highlighting the limits of our power. On the contrary, I see many ways a rejuvenation of American power. When the President Biden came in, the first thing he said was, I want you to go out and reinvigorate, reengage, and if necessary, reimagine our partnerships and our alliances around the world. He did that for a very clear reason. As we saw the world and America's place in it, we had two basic conclusions. One is that when the United States is not engaged, when we're not leading, either you're going to let someone else who is, and probably not in a way that advances our interests and values. Or maybe, just as bad, you get no one, and then you have a vacuum filled by bad things. American engagement and leadership was one side of the coin. But the flip side is finding a way to cooperate, to collaborate, to communicate with all sorts of actors who have increasingly powerful roles in shaping the direction of the world. The fact that for all the power that we have, which remains extraordinarily over every domain, we're simply not as effective at getting solutions and solving problems alone as we are when we're doing it with others. Garrett, where have you seen those alliances and partnerships come into play? Blinken. We see it with Ukraine, where we brought together more than 50 countries in defense of Ukraine, not just in Europe, but halfway around the world in Asia, and taking steps to support Ukraine to penalize Russia, to strengthen our own alliance in NATO that are genuinely historic. That's a product of our leadership. We see a tremendous convergence on the approach to China and the challenges that it poses, both in the transatlantic community and also with critical allies and partners in Asia. In the time we've been doing this, I've never seen a greater convergence on how to think about the challenges and then what to do about them. We built alliances on everything from global health, dealing effectively with COVID, and getting vaccines out there to maybe the biggest affliction that the United States faces, fentanyl. This is the number one killer of Americans aged 18 to 45. Not guns, not car accidents, not cancer. Fentanyl. Not only have we used our diplomacy to get greater cooperation from China in starting to limit the flow of the chemical precursors, the ingredients that go into making fentanyl, we built an alliance, now more than 150 countries, that is working together to curb the diversion of these precursors around the world. And when we engage, when we lead, when we do it in a way that brings others along, this has actually been a manifestation of American power. Garrett, what do you feel you've learned about the world in this job that you didn't know coming into it? Lincoln, I had obviously some ideas built up over more than 30 years of doing this, but like anything, you've got plans, you've got ideas, and then you've got first contact, and you just have to adjust. Two things have, I'm not sure if they surprised me, but they've clearly been spotlighted in ways that were even sharper than I might have imagined. One is that there is greater complexity, greater multiplicity, and greater interconnectedness of the challenges we face than any time since I've been doing this. That really stood out. I knew that intuitively, but you don't really know it is until you're dealing with it. We always have rose-tinted glasses on about the past to some extent. The second thing is, in the time that I've been working in government, the single biggest change for me has been in the information environment. When I started out at the beginning of the Clinton administration, basically everyone did the same two things. You got up in the morning, you opened the front door of your house or apartment, and you picked up a hard copy of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal. Then if you had a TV in your office at 6:30 p.m., you turned it on and watched the network news, CBS, NBC, ABC. Those were your basic sources of information. They defined your day. Now, of course, we're at an intravenous speed where every millisecond we're getting some new jolt of information. The pressure to respond, to react, is so much more intense. This has driven home the need to have as much discipline as possible in taking a breath, not simply reacting and responding, but to take the time to collect your thoughts, to get together with all the other stakeholders on a given problem, and to spend some time thinking it through. The pressure in the other direction is more intense than it's ever been. Garrett, you've been part of a big arc in how Washington has thought about China over the past 30 years. Blinken, there was a Washington consensus for many, many years that China's integration, particularly economic integration, would have an effect on its political system and the way it engaged around the world. We've seen that consensus in recent years evaporate because we do see a China that, from their perspective, for maybe understandable reasons, does seek to be the predominant actor in the world. Military, diplomatically, politically, economically. Now, if they had the same basic value set that we do, if they had the same basic interests, that would be one thing, but they don't. They have a different worldview. So this represents for us an intense competition because we're at the dawn of a new era. We're past the post-Cold War era, and there's an intense competition to shape what comes next. We're competing with China to do that. Garrett, what have you learned about China here in this job? Blinken, you can't simply define the relationship on a bumper sticker. If I had to pick one word, it's competition. For Americans, there's nothing wrong with competition. On the contrary, competition, as long as it's fair, as long as it's on a level playing field, usually brings out the best in us. But we also want to make sure that it's competition that doesn't generate conflict. There are other aspects to the relationship that are important too. And this is why the bumper sticker would have to be a pretty long one. As arguably the two most important players in the world, there are places it's going to be in the interest of the American people and the Chinese people, and those of people around the world to cooperate, to effectively communicate, so we minimize the chances of conflict even as we're competing. We restored military-to-military communications. It's critical to avoid any misunderstanding. And that's happening on all levels. That's good. Garrett, Elon Musk is an American citizen with an enormous amount of geopolitical power. We've seen it in Ukraine with Starlink. We've seen it with X and the Venezuelan elections. How worried are you about Elon Musk's role in the world and the divergence between U.S. tech platforms and U.S. foreign policy? Blinken, I'm not going to focus on any one individual. We, of course, see the extraordinary power, the extraordinary impact that platforms have, just as we do with companies that have developed foundational technologies, including generative AI. We want to see platforms, companies, and innovators act responsibly, and that involves a number of things. First, it involves, hopefully, collaboration between the federal government and these companies. We've done that intensely and extensively. I've met many times with the leaders of different critical companies to talk through how they're seeing the world and how we're seeing it. How we're from the federal government, we're here to help, and how we can do that. A big part of this is making sure that we're helping to establish the rules, norms, and standards by which technology is used. In an ideal world, companies and platforms will do a lot of that themselves. In many ways, that would be preferable. Sometimes, when the government comes in, it does things with a 2x4 instead of with a scalpel. Garrett, how do you use tech in your life? Do you have a burner account on Instagram that you scroll in the evening? TikTok? What websites do you visit during the day? Blinken. I've got a lot of go-to places that I start my day with on my iPhone, but I shouldn't be doing brand advertising, so I'll probably stay away from that. The big threat in my life is music. It's the thing I come back to again and again. Tech makes my ability to connect to and to consume music much, much easier. It's really opened whole new worlds. Garrett, has being a dad changed the way that you look at tech? Blinken. Like any parent with young kids, it's both exhilarating and a little bit frightening. You see the extraordinary facility children have with technology, and you see the technology designed so brilliantly, intuitively. When my son was maybe 3, he wanted to watch some Sesame Street videos on my iPhone. We, of course, limit the amount of time they spend on TV, but they see some of it. I couldn't believe watching him as a 3-year-old, and then my daughter intuitively scroll and swipe. But when I saw my son go on a site to get a video of Sesame Street and hit skip ad, that was an eye-opener. Garrett, what are the stakes of this election? Is it challenging to go around the world and talk about the glories of democracy as our democracy has struggled so at home? Blinken. In a funny way, no. The latter part of your question. When I'm going around the world and raising concerns that we may have about the direction of another country's democracy, what I am able to say is that when we have problems here in our country, we don't pretend they don't exist. We don't sweep them under the rug. We actually confront them. We do it transparently. We argue about it. We shout about it, but we confront it. Sometimes it's incredibly painful. Sometimes it's incredibly ugly, but we do it. Throughout our history, when we've had periods of real challenge internally, precisely because we confront the challenges openly, directly, we've always come out better and stronger. At the very least, what I'm able to say to countries is, okay, we're not saying do exactly what we do or model yourselves exactly after us. We're not about that. But at least acknowledge, confront, and deal with your challenges. Garrett, do you think in this moment that's true too, that we'll come out the other side of this political movement even stronger? Blinken. I have to believe, I want to believe, based on my own knowledge and understanding of our history, that the answer is yes. But of course, in my job, I don't do politics. I'm focused on policies. I'm focused on how we can best advance our interests and values around the world in ways that will have a positive impact on Americans, make us all a little bit more secure and a little bit more prosperous, a little bit healthier. Garrett. When you leave this office, whenever that is, who are the world leaders you're going to invite to your world band tour? Blinken. It's a great question, and one that I could probably answer when I'm out of this job, at the risk of creating a diplomatic incident while I'm still in it. I can reel off the names of a lot of people who I have genuine friendships with that will continue after we're out of our respective positions. But there's something else. I get to meet people from all walks of life doing incredible things. Innovating, solving problems, dealing with adversity. It reinforces something that I believed coming into this, and now I feel even more strongly. Any challenge we face, I'm convinced that somewhere in our great country, or maybe somewhere around the world, someone has probably figured out the answer, at least the beginnings of an answer. If you can't connect, if you can't share that knowledge, share that information, share that experience, then everyone's going to have to reinvent the wheel and trying to solve the same problem over and over again. Garrett, you spent 30 years in Washington and have now achieved every foreign policy staffer's terminal dream. Whenever you leave this job, what's next for you? What's your next ambition? Blinken. It's really hard to think about what comes next when you're in the midst of doing what you're doing now because it's all consuming. I'm also blessed with two young children at a relatively advanced age. For me, the single most important thing, like for any parent, is them and their future, and watching them grow up, participating in them growing up. Garrett, when you leave this office, are we going to see more posting on your Spotify, Abe Lincoln? I thought at a young age maybe I wanted to try music as a career, and then I realized I was missing one thing, talent. I'm not sure I want to inflict any more music on the world. I actually hope to talk about what comes next, to get to attend a few concerts. That would be great. Alfonso Cuarón and Samantha Subramanian. With Alfonso Cuarón, you never know what's next, and sometimes neither does he. The director leaps from genre to genre, a Dickens adaptation to a central road movie about two teenage boys, to a blockbuster Harry Potter sequel, to a dystopia about infertility, to a thriller set in low Earth orbit, to a meditative drama about a housekeeper in wealthy Mexican household filmed in black and white. What unites these stories is Cuarón's particular sensibility, or what he calls his cinematic language. His camera rarely stops moving. His films regularly deliver tiny, unexpected moments, a woman shyly revealing herself to be pregnant in Children of Men, a stranded astronaut making radio contact with an Inuit man and his own dogs down on Earth in gravity, and that feeling intimate and grand at the same time. For each of his own past two films, Cuarón won the Best Director Oscar. His first big project since 2018's Roma is not a movie but a television show, Disclaimer, which stars Cate Blanchett and Kevin Klein and streams on Apple TV. Its 7 episodes are marvels of engineered tension. Mysteries turn inside out. Narrators grow unreliable. Facts evaporate. And the sand never stops shifting. This summer in London, I spoke with Cuarón about what it takes to make a TV feel like cinema. We talked about science fiction. Two of Cuarón's films, Children of Men and Gravity, routinely make lists of the best movies ever made in the genre, but he doesn't really see them that way. His films about the future are, he says, studies of what life is already like for some people, and the precarious realities we don't like to confront here in the present day. Subramanian asks, this must be your first time out talking about a big project since Roma in 2018, back before the pandemic. I thought about your movies a lot during the lockdown for a particular reason. Every time I've seen a film of yours, I've associated it with this feeling of claustrophobia. Whether it's physical claustrophobia, like when you're moving the camera into Sandra Bullock's helmet in Gravity, or an emotional claustrophobia like the world closing in around you. Cuarón, first of all, I apologize for making you feel like that. I'm glad, I guess, but this is the first time I've been confronted with it. It was not a conscious decision, but most stuff is like that when you make a film. It's up to the audience to find meaning. Subramanian. In any case, it got me wondering, what was your pandemic like? Cuarón. Well, I guess similar to everybody's, just locked into the house. At first, I was trying to figure out if there was something I could do. And I sorted out many, many thousands of masks to be sent to Mexico for their nurses in the hospital. Then I started working on Disclaimer. And how did that project come to your attention? Renee Knight and I have acquaintances in common. She sent me the manuscript and I really liked it. I just didn't know how to make it happen as a conventional film. And so time passed. And I went to do Roma. And toward the end of that, Knight got in touch saying, hey, in case you're interested, the rights are available. And that was a moment when I was very intrigued about exploring episodic TV. I enjoy many series, and they have amazing writing and amazing acting, but only very few have cinematic approach, so I was intrigued. How can you hijack the conventional writer-oriented show into something that is closer to cinema? And what do you mean here by cinematic approach? In film, you take images and put them in a relationship with other images to convey a meaning. There's a visual layer and a visual way which stories are told. In order to do that, you have to have surrender to it. Many series cannot be concerned about that. They need to keep moving the narrative forward constantly. The narrative is leading the show. That's their amazing strength. narratively, they've started doing way more than interesting things than most mainstream American films. But in the worst cases, you can watch many series with your eyes closed. And by the way, you can still have a great time. You can actually be doing things while you're watching the show. My wife does embroidery while she's watching some of these shows. Yeah, and you're talking once in a while. That's their value. Another thing is, I'd never done anything overly narrative, and it was very intrigued by the challenge. I'd always favored a more cinematic language to convey ideas rather than just strong narrative impulse. Can you say a little more about what you mean by overly narrative? When you have a narrative, you can go A, then B, then C, then D, then E, then F, and so on. In films, you have to somehow convey everything you need, and this is what I mean about cinematic language, to go from A to D. But there are two principles that are contradictory, and I learned these by working on this show. The principle of film is time. It's how those images flow in time, and all the emotions that they convey in time. Television, on the other hand, is about killing time. It's killing time to keep the narrative flowing. During doing disclaimer, there were cinematic moments that I loved, but I also knew that if I held the shot here, people watching were going to check their messages. You mentioned holding a shot. There's that moment in Y Tú Mamá También, when the camera turns inside the car, it turns around, looks out of the back window, and focuses on cops stopping someone on the road. And then it turns back to the front seat where the stars are talking about foreplay. It's the kind of the moment that wouldn't fit in a series, because in a series, it's just the lead characters and their lead actions, one after another, killing time. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, by the way. Of course, maybe occupying time then? Yes, maybe that's a less radical expression of it. The important thing of most films is to do the relationship between the character and the environment. It's always the clash between these two, and in Y Tú Mamá, it was like these guys are in their little stupid drama cruising through the greater reality that they are oblivious to. And don't get me wrong, shows have amazing cinematic moments. Chernobyl is a great example, The Bear as well, but they are not consistent throughout the whole show. Part of the nature of most shows is that you have several directors going through each series, different directors doing different episodes. So it's hard to have a strong directorial point of view from A to Z, a certain attention to detail that has a casual effect in the whole show. The great ones establish a style, and then different filmmakers come to honor that style through the whole series. In the irresponsible decision that I made to direct all 7 episodes of Disclaimer, it's like I'm doing a film, but it's very, very long.